Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Oh, Google Assistant again. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the Breakfast Club, which is just some records basically. I'm gonna play some tunes for half an hour and get myself woke up properly because I'm still half asleep. I've got to go to the job centre for a Universal Credit meeting in about an hour and a half, and I need to be coherent and articulate for that, so this is going to wake me up. This is Manly P. Hall. Speaking about earthquakes.
According to the Japanese, the five great terrors are earthquakes, thunders, floods, fires, and father. And to most of them, I imagine, father is the principal cause of anxiety. But these people, incidentally, have on average are from 1,200 to 1,500 earthquakes a year. Therefore, it is only natural that they've given some thought to the matter. And while their thinking is perhaps a little empirical, it may be well to consider it for a moment and see if we can learn something that is a little different from the present approach to the problems of these seismic catastrophes. The Japanese believe that earthquakes are caused by a catfish. Now, this is perhaps an exaggeration, but it is called the pidget fish, and it is somewhere asleep under Japan. And every once in a while it wiggles and shakes its tail, and down comes a city or two. And this has resulted in a peculiar love for catfish. About 6 months ago, there was a prophecy in Japan of a serious impending earthquake. What happened? Everybody that could do so bought a catfish. Instead of moving or anything of that nature, they found either a little pond or a bowl or a tank or something and put the catfish in it. And thousands of years of experience has taught them that the first thing that will note or register an impending earthquake is a catfish. The moment that fish gets excited, hysterical, wiggles around, and tries to jump out of the tank, every one of the villagers head for the bamboo groves. They know an earthquake is coming, and it comes. Now, this led to a series of interesting experiments concerning the possibility of the foreknowledge of earthquakes. We are inclined to suspect at the present time that sonar or radar or something of that nature is the factor that causes animals, birds, and other non-human creatures to have better awareness of earthquake difficulties than the average human being. But in the Orient, there's another factor involved that seems to be worthwhile to consider. Some years ago, about the middle of the 19th century, a Japanese watch repairer had the habit of hanging the small parts of a watch's mechanism on magnets to keep them so he could get them when he wanted them and they wouldn't get lost or disappear. One day, while he was hard at work with one of his watches, all of these magnets discharged the pieces hung on them. And there was a little crash of small parts falling on his workbench. He didn't pay much attention to it at that moment, but about 10 minutes later, the earthquake hit. So this began to be a matter of consideration. The villagers picked it up, and they had an earthquake alarm that probably is one of the earliest that we know. This consisted of a large iron ball hung from a magnet. And below the ball was a bronze or iron dish, large, like a great boiler. And the warning was that if the ball dropped on the metal dish and made a loud noise, it was a good idea for the people to head for the bamboo grove. Why the bamboo grove? Obviously, because the roots of the bamboo knot into tangles that are so tight that the ground can open under them and the roots will hold up anyone who is hanging onto the roots. So this was a way in which they began to experiment with earthquake phenomena. And of course, with the susceptibility of that country, such research and such study was certainly important. It may be that, like acupuncture and several other Oriental methods of handling situations, we will ultimately have more interest, not necessarily in iron balls or detached magnets, but in the general theory that they have, namely, that an earthquake is always heralded by a form of natural magnetism being disarranged. This disarrangement, however, is not followed instantly by the earthquake. It may be followed within an hour or so, or it may be followed the next day. But the warning is almost always ultimately met with an appropriate termination. There is an earthquake. Years ago, it was noted that animals had peculiar ability to anticipate earthquakes. There was a very important quake off the coast of Peru, and a large part of the coastline fell into the sea. This coastline had for years been a grazing ground for cattle. They grazed free in this area. When it fell off into the sea, there was not a single head of cattle lost. They had all quietly left. And many other such accounts are known to anticipate the possibility that earthquakes are perhaps a magnetic phenomena, as well as possibly a physical one. Some have assumed, and there's been some scientific support for this, that an earthquake begins in the heavy side layer of the atmosphere, that it is very much like a discharge of lightning. It is something which, as energy, strikes an area where the fission lines of the planet are particularly susceptible. This blow, this stroke of energy, results in a motion of the physical earth. Now, trying to work out some of these mysteries, we go back to Plato's account of the sinking of Atlantis. He was very simple in his repetition of the information received from Solon, who in turn had gained it from the Egyptians. According to Plato, the great Atlantic catastrophe was a punishment for sin. It was the way in which the gods avenged the abuse and misuse of the privileges and powers which they had bestowed upon mankind. The corruption of human usage, the misuse of earth energies, the pollution of earth resources, we would say could, in the end, of course, bring about such a disaster. But to the Greeks, it was not only brought about, but it was ordered, arranged, and fulfilled by divine will. The gods were responsible for punishing the guilty. Looking into the problems as we know them in our daily life, the ancients, particularly following the Hermetic disciplines, believed that the microcosm, which is man, was a miniature of all other things that exist in nature, and that the human being was the most available textbook for the study of any type of phenomena that can arise in the larger environment. We know very much now concerning the causes of sickness. Not all, but quite a bit. We know also the effect of dispositions upon health. We realize how the abuse or misuse or corruption of human emotions or thoughts will ultimately destroy the body. We also realize how excesses and the abuse of the natural resources of the body can result in premature infirmity. All of these factors are more or less generally recognized. But how would we apply such a situation or such a condition to the larger world in which we live, the universal environment? To the ancients, one and all, east and west, the planet Earth was considered to be a living thing. It was not just simply a mass of metals or substances of lava or rocks whirling around in space. It was a being with the attributes of a being. And one of their reasons for assuming this is that nothing can produce nothing. And the fact that this planet maintains an infinite diversity of life dependent upon the planet would make it appear or be assumed that the planet itself is a source of life and therefore must be alive. For that which is dead cannot be the source of life. Now, the planet itself, if we want to consider it as a living thing, which practically all of ancient people did, they considered it a goddess, the great mother of all life. And that from this great mother came forth all of the kingdoms of material existence in this world. That the planet Earth was the great nurse, the mother. It was the bride of the sun and the daughter or wife of God. It was the symbol of the productiveness and fruitfulness of existence so far as the human being was concerned. Assuming as the ancients did, and perhaps with proper insight, better than we have, because we are now determined to make everything sterile, mechanical, physical, material, and to deny all other factors in the constitutions of living things. The ancients did not have this point of view, and some will say, well, maybe we outgrew what the ancients thought. Maybe they were superstitious and wrong, and we are right. But let us give a second thought to that. Most of the wisdom of antiquity originated before what we may call the age of sophistication. Ancient peoples were simple. They had very little to unlearn. They were not surrounded by highly opinionated specialists who were constantly interfering with the natural processes of the heart and mind. They were not overwhelmed by schools. They were not dominated by widespread theories. They were not made up primarily of scoffers or cynics. They were very simple, natural people, and their wisdom was the wisdom of the folk. Now, the folk, perhaps, in its wisdom, like the folk in its art, has a tremendous integrity. It represents the natural reaction of the individual, directed and moved by common sense and by the common experiences of daily life. Therefore, the primitive instincts and intuitions of humanity may well be more correct than the sophisticated, involved doctrines and beliefs that we hold to today. In any event, the ancient peoples were inclined to think of the earth as a living thing. It was not simply a footstool for deity, nor was it merely some kind of a meteor floating in space. It was a being, part of a great hierarchy of beings inhabiting space. The Buddhists called this great space family a cosmotheism, and they said that it was a vast cosmic space democracy. That in this was all the law that man could possibly need or use. That every aspect of life that was necessary for the protection and unfoldment of human society was already traced in the universe itself. And that there was no way in which we could go against the universe and survive, or at least survive with dignity. Now, assuming for a moment that the Earth is alive, At least it is vital. It may not have a disposition like ours, although sometimes it seems to be almost miraculously wise and clever. It seems to have abilities to solve problems that human beings cannot solve. One thing we know definitely is that the earth, as the alchemist pointed out, is a kind of great bottle. And in this bottle is an infinite mixture of chemical factors. This bottle contains within it all of the elements necessary for the production of the Philosopher's Stone, or the transmutations of all gross substances into their mystical and spiritual equivalents. Now, if this planet is a bottle, then like all other bottles, it has capacity. Like all other bottles, it can only be filled, and it can only be emptied. And unless something is taken from it, no more can be added once it is full. And if there is no source for the replenishment of the contents of the bottle, then when it is empty, that is the end. So at the moment, some people, including a number of Chinese researchers, are beginning to question whether or not man is wise in constantly exploiting the natural resources of the earth. Is it perfectly pleasant, happy, safe, and sound, and quite in the order of things, to drain out petroleum? Is it proper to go on mining for the natural metals and elements of the earth? Is it possible to go through all kinds of processes of transformations resulting in corruption of the atmosphere and pollution of the water? What are we doing to this tired old person that we call the earth? If it is really a person, it is in a pretty poor shape and is getting poorer all the time. Now, we know that the gravitational pull of the earth and its relation to the sun and the orbits of the other planets, that these are controlled factors. And these controlled factors, in all probability, depend upon the internal construction of the earth itself. It has to have certain polarities. It has to have certain resources in order to remain in its orbit as it should. If human ingenuity depletes the natural resources and energies of the planet until nothing remains, its fertility is very apt to be destroyed, and it may sometime, like the broken planet, which is now called Lucifer, be disintegrated in space because it has been exhausted of its resources. Come down to the human being. It may be occasionally necessary for a man to give a little blood to a neighbor who is in trouble, so there's a blood transfusion. But if this individual was required to give transfusions every day throughout his life, he'd be dead in a few weeks. And if we take from the earth the vital necessities by a kind of transfusion and then dissipate them in our own industrialized culture, we are ultimately going to land in a very serious disaster. And this disaster can include nearly every type of cataclysm because of the various forms of depletion of which we are guilty. Now, there's no real need to get terribly excited about this, perhaps, because it's not likely to happen in our lifetimes, or maybe for many more centuries to come. But unless something is done to conserve resources, there is no question in the world that ultimately the energy bottle will be empty. And when that happens, we are going to find many very difficult situations to face. If you study the human being very carefully, you must realize also that the microcosm, which is man, is a little solar system in itself. There are planets within the human body, and to the various vital organs, planetary correspondences have been assigned. There are also various systems within the body which can be separated by the autopsy physician. There is the nervous system. There is the arterial system, the venous system, the lymphatic system. There are muscles and sinews and bones, systems of structures which, by working together and receiving appropriate nutrition, maintain the equilibrium of man's physical existence. Now, if various artificial means are used to corrupt the health of the individual, these systems are going to be impaired. And through various dissipations or indifferences or wrong attitudes, the entire bodily structure can be damaged. Actually, it appears also that the human being has a territorial allotment, like the tiger, the lion, the elephant, and the bear. When he sets up headquarters somewhere, he sets aside a territory. And within this territory, he must exist. He must feed himself and his young. He must do whatever is necessary to survive, and he must defend this territory against encroachment. In man, what we would term the territory may be likened to the magnetic field of the human body. The ancients were well aware of this. Plato, Plutarch, and several others have written about it. And they have also noted that the physical body of man exists within a kind of invisible bubble, which has been called in metaphysics the aura. This has been photographed. It can be seen with the aid of the Kilner screens, and its effect in terms of magnetism can be estimated with great certainty. And in his researches, Rickenbach was very clear in his ability to show and demonstrate the magnetic environment around every living thing. Now, if the human body has a magnetic field, then this magnetic field becomes the real source of the life of that body. This magnetic field envelops the physical form. It is the source of that form. It is the direct energizer of it. The life in man is not within the body, but within the magnetic field. And it communicates with the body through a series of very sensitive structures, of which the endocrine system is an example. This body, which contains the vital organs that we know, is therefore surrounded by a territory. That part of universal space which is allotted to the growth, development, and maintenance of a single creature. Everyone has this type of magnetic field, and it has been used in a number of interesting ways. It not only is apparent from an energy standpoint, but is probably responsible for most of the parapsychological phenomena that we know today, much of which we accept without question. It is probably involved in the system of acupuncture. It is involved in the yin-yang concepts of the Tao Te Ching and all of these ancient systems. For our purpose at the moment, though, the idea is that this bottle, which is the magnetic field, not only encloses us, but serves as a kind of capacity which we have. Our mental, emotional, and physical activities reflect into this. Our thoughts go into this magnetic field, change its color, change its structure, and can, in many instances, damage it. Our emotional pressures do the same thing. And photographing and studying the magnetic field, as Kilner did, reveals clearly that the emotions and attitudes of persons change the colors of the magnetic field, change the vibratory rates of this auric structure in which we exist. If these auric rates are damaged by negative attitudes, it's hard to imagine, for instance, that a neurotic attitude could cause rheumatic situations in the body. It probably couldn't unless this attitude went first into the magnetic field and then was then siphoned into the body through one of the endocrine glands. In any event, we have a physical body that is extremely sensitive to the law of cause and effect. Every attitude that we have has its own life principle. Words and thoughts are living things, and they feed into the magnetic field, and from there are fed back again into the body of the person. We find the same type of problem in smog. The Earth's atmosphere accepts the smog of industry and then returns it with interest, bringing with it condition which is desperately dangerous to human survival. The same.
All right, that's Manly P. Hall. Started talking about earthquakes and ended up talking about the magnetic properties of the human energy field. So that's pretty broad as far as the topic's concerned. It's the same principle, though. It all comes from electromagnetism. And the link with the endocrine system is absolutely key. That's critical. Because that's how you solve the problem, is to improve the way your endocrine system functions. And the endocrine system is the chakra system. It's a direct one-to-one correlation there. So that's a blueprint of how to improve thought processes and emotional processes and health processes eventually. You improve one, improve two, and then improve the third as a result of improving the quality of your thoughts and the quality of your emotions. All right, that's enough from me. I don't need to do any commentary on that. That seems pretty straightforward to me. But I've been working with these systems for years. So if you're not familiar, then leave a comment and I'll do some commentary and try my best to explain it in a way that's simple and practical. All right, thanks for listening. And I'll see you again later on today.